The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fake uniforms, surreptitious GPS trackers, torches to sever anchors, alcohol, prostitutes, even witch doctors. These are among the tools of the trade for a handful of repo men scouring ports and waterways around the globe. Often hired by banks, insurers, or ship owners, they operate in the ill-regulated, highly corrupt, and unfathomably vast seas, where each year tens of thousands of ships are stolen, impounded, or swindled, not by Somali pirates, but by white-collar buccaneers. Ian Urbina is investigative reporter for The New York Times. He's uncovered stories of slavery, summary executions, stealing, and selling organs, all taking place on the high seas. His most recent report is on maritime repo men. Ian Urbina, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what a story. What kind of ships are these repo men, and they are all men in your story, hired to find?
So most often they're hired for an order of ship called tramp steamers, and these are typically older cargo ships. They're big, but they're not, you know, Captain Phillips-style container ships. They're not the huge ones. And tramp steamers are a certain order of cargo ship that doesn't have a home port and kind of lives job by job and typically are bouncing between second and third world countries, you know, moving foodstuffs or fuel or raw goods, computers, from one place to another. And those are the most vulnerable because they're going to ports that are notoriously corrupt, and they often don't have insurance, and sort of they're easy prey for scam artists.
So these repo guys that you spoke to, they get hired to negotiate or recover or extract. That's a term they use. Now, how often does it actually come to that?
Not often. You know, so the vast majority of repo work is kind of a ho-hum affair with, you know, paperwork and police who, you know, serve an order and it's carried out. And that's true the world over. A small subset are more entangled where there's some sort of complication. You know, maybe the person who is supposed to have their ship taken says, sure, yeah, I did damage your port, and I can't pay for it, so you can take my ship. But someone else gets involved, like the local dock where it's stuck, and says, wait, you can't take that ship because they owe me money. And then it gets entangled. And so these are sort of when it gets dodgy, and they fly in one of these, you know, extraction guys, you know, who are specialized in this. And step one is to try to negotiate, as one guy said, negotiate them back to planet Earth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a million-dollar ship could be looking at a $50 million fine because the locals don't realize that's a ridiculous sum. And so the guy is flown in, and he has to sort of talk them back down to the reasonable realm. If he succeeds, then, you know, they pay it off and the ship gets on its way. If they fail, then the ship is still stuck, and that's when, as a last resort, an extraction occurs, which is sort of a waterborne jailbreak.
Well, tell us about some of these extractions. I mean, really sound dangerous for one thing, but also really challenging. You talked to Chris Meacham. He is based in Jacksonville, Florida, a maritime repo man. He and his team spirited hundreds of boats out of a marina in Mexico. How does this happen?
What these guys, you know, again, like you said, they're all guys that I spoke to, typically do is have a decided policy of never being armed and never using violence. So, you know, most of these guys also have an ethic of the crew are just sort of innocent middlemen, bystanders, if you will, and so they never do anything to harm the crew. That means if you're not going to use violence and weapons and intimidation, then you're going to have to use guile and kind of trickery. And so most of them do just that. They sort of go in, they do surveillance, they figure out kind of what the landscape looks like, quite literally. You know, can they get the vessel out? Or is it being blocked by other vessels? You know, how well guarded is it? Are there downtimes, you know, during shift change of the night watchman? All these sorts of things. And then they often hire locals, you know, prostitutes or street kids or bar owners or the like, to help them either do surveillance, which sometimes involves getting someone on the vessel to see if it has fuel, to see how many guards are on there. Is it even the right vessel? Sometimes these have been, you know, welded to look differently, painted over, etc., and you need to get to the engine room and check the serial numbers on the engine to make sure you're even looking at the vessel that you're supposed to recover.
So I guess that's where the costumes come in.
Yeah, you know, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, I would never have, maybe a better fiction writer than I would have thought this stuff up. But, you know, a lot of these guys have a closet of uniforms, sort of all-purpose uniforms, overalls, you know, royal blue overalls or gray overalls or whatnot, and they take some of them and they have business cards and they sort of size up the situation when they get in country and decide, you know, what ploy might work, if any ploy is needed. Sometimes it's basic, you know, you just watch and you realize there's a gap in the middle of the night when it's not, no one's watching, and they swim out and they climb on board and they start it up, and they run. And they run to the 12, you know, is what they call it. The 12-mile line is the dividing line between national and international waters. And if you can get into international waters, then you're pretty much in good shape.
Ian Urbina is with us. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. And he's uncovered these stories of men hired to take back ships that have been stolen, docked, scrubbed to hide their identity by gun runners and human traffickers and even terrorists. Well, you spoke to a Haitian Coast Guard official who referred to them as vigilantes. So what's happening here? Is what they are doing legal?
No, I don't think it's legal. I don't think it's illegal. I think it's sort of extra legal, you know. You know, and I'm not trying to be Pollyanna, but I do believe that right, laws reside in country for the most part. There is international law, right? But most laws that apply to most of us in normal life are domestic, or they're national laws. And the laws that these guys are breaking are, from one perspective, real and exist, and they're local, they're national or even provincial, and they are breaking those. They're sort of taking matters into their own hands sometimes and not properly contacting the police and having them carried out, and maybe they're even going around a local judge who said that they're not allowed to take it. On the other hand, what these guys would argue is that they are breaking one law because another law has been broken, and that this is a fraudulent seizure, which is illegal. Even if it's legal in country, it's unethical. And if they can just get that vessel to another jurisdiction where there's a level playing field, again, I'm channeling them, this is what they would argue, and often they do. They take the ship, say, from Haiti to Barbados or a place, the Bahamas, where these are countries where there's more sympathy in the courts to banks and American interests, for example, mm-hmm. than, say, Havana or Venezuela or Colombia or Jamaica. And so they take the ship there, and then they make their argument before a judge in those countries that their repossession was legitimate. And even if the Haitians or Colombians are not happy about it, you know, they want this judge in this country to decide the matter.
Ian Urbina, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ian Urbina, he's an investigative reporter for The New York Times, and you'll find a link to read some of the stories he has uncovered about human trafficking and slavery on shrimp boats and piracy on the high seas, including the photographs, terrific photographs, and full text of his most recent report, Maritime Repo Men, A Last Resort for Stolen Ships. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2004, experimental psychologist Charles Spence published a groundbreaking academic paper titled The Role of Auditory Cues in Modulating the Perceived Crispness and Staleness of Potato Chips. In it, he laid out his findings on the extent to which the sound a chip makes when we bite into it influences our perception of its taste. In simple terms, do crunchier sounding potato chips taste better? Well, while it's been long known that the smell and color of food greatly shapes taste, it turns out sound also plays a big role. Nicola Twilley delved into the world of multi-sensory perception in an article for The New Yorker. It's called The Illusion of Taste. Nicola is also the co-host of the Gastropod podcast. And Nicola, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
So tell us about Charles Spence's Pringles study.
Yes, he had volunteers eat 200 Pringles each in the name of science. So a tough task, but someone had to do it. And what he found, it was an interesting setup. So he had the folks sitting in soundproof booth. They were wearing headphones, sitting in front of a mic, told to crunch into a Pringle. Now, of course, because they had the headphones on, they weren't hearing their own crunch. They were hearing the recorded sound of the crunch from the mic, fed through an amplifier and either boosted or muffled, and fed back into their ears. So Charles Spence, the scientist, was sort of playing with the sound of the crunch that they were hearing, but they thought it was the sound of the Pringle crunching in their mouth.
So what was the result?
Well, that was what was so extraordinary, that the people all sort of got out of the booth at the end and said, you know, some of those cans of Pringles had been sitting open for too long. Some of those Pringles were stale. What Spence found once he analyzed all the results was that you can make Pringles taste 15% more fresh or stale, like a taste difference of 15%, just by altering the sound. If you muffle it down and take out the high-pitched notes, people think Pringles are stale.
So why is that so groundbreaking? I mean, I think, yeah, crunchier chip must be fresher.
Right. And what's so interesting about it, I mean, it's logical, but what's so interesting about it is scientists had not really studied how our various different senses work together. They had spent a long time studying our senses individually. But of course, when you eat something, it's the most multi-sensory experience there is. And what Spence managed to do was sort of tease out the rules by which the brain combines that information. So in the case of a Pringle, your brain thinks that the sound is more reliable than the cue from your mouth. And so that's what it believes, in that it puts that together into a coherent picture in your brain. And you never know that's what's going on, but that's what's going on.
I also found that higher pitch sounds are connected to sweet taste, so not just crunchier, so less stale. How did he figure that out, and any theories as to why?
So this is an interesting one and really worth trying at home with, say, if you have coffee or beer and you play high-pitched music, you can make it taste really almost, I mean, it's some crazy percentage, it's significantly, noticeably more, 10% more sweet than if you're listening to lower pitched music. And even though, I mean, I was as skeptical as anybody, and it works. And so the reasoning behind it, he thinks, is perhaps it's to do with almost the shape your mouth makes when you're making a high pitched sound. So your tongue moves upward and outward when you're making a high-pitched sound, and that's also how, say, a baby's tongue moves in response to sweet foods. So there's some sort of biological connection there with almost your mouth shape and a sweet taste and a high-pitched sound.
It's fascinating to think of taste buds maybe not being even as important as sight and sound and smell and touch.
Yeah,
that play into taste.
Yeah, Spence, I mean, you know, you often hear that smell is a lot of our experience of the flavor of food. Spence, Charles Spence, is saying, well, at least 50% of our experience of food and drink is determined by sound and vision and touch. Those are flavor senses, too. It's not just smell and taste.
We went to your article in The New Yorker, and there's actually a little audio test that we can take. So let's do that right now. This is questioning whether you can identify whether water being poured into a glass is hot or cold simply by listening to it. Let's listen. Just listening, can you tell the difference, Nicola?
I think I can. I mean, now I'm going to be wrong on air, but I think the first one was the hot one and the second one was the cold, right?
I thought so too, but I don't know if I could identify exactly why.
Well, that is the magic of this. But what's crazy about it is now Charles Fence is using that insight into the fact that we can tell temperature from sound. So can he use that in, say, the sound a can makes when it's opening to make your beer taste more refreshing or your soda taste more refreshing? Simply changing the pitch that the can makes when you sort of pop it open, that could make us think it's colder.
Well, you're hitting on something I was wondering about. I mean, the commercial food industry would be all over this. Have marketers leapt on his findings?
I wouldn't say that they've leapt on it. When the Pringle experiment happened, for example, in 2004, it really hardly caused a ripple outside of academia. But gradually, people are starting to realize it started actually with celebrity chefs picking up on it, Heston Blumenthal in the UK, sort of picking up on some of this and using it to create high-end dining experiences. And then the marketers have started to jump on it. So one of the things that Spence has actually worked on that's not food-related is the sound of deodorant, Axe deodorant. He found that you could tweak the sort of whooshing sound that the spray deodorant makes to make it seem more masculine and more effective. And so he did that.
So it roars when it comes out.
Exactly. If you buy sort of a can of Dove and a can of Axe and sort of spray them side by side, the Dove is like psst, and the Axe is
I have to say, though, it makes me bristle a little bit thinking of children already drawn to bright packaging, you know, consuming sugary foods. It feels like manipulation. What might be the fallout from sound designing packaged food?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is manipulation, and there's no real way around that. What Spence argues is like, look, these effects are real. We share them. They're there. The question is how we're going to use them, not sort of if. And he points to all the ways in which you can use them for good. So, for example, you could use them to lower the amount of sugar in a soft drink if you use the right packaging. Red packaging has been shown to make things taste sweeter, as much as 20% sweeter. And so why not package in red, lower the sugar content, and help public health that way? On the other hand, yes. He has worked with Unilever. He has worked with a lot of major food and beverage companies. And it is, you know, the big companies that make the packaged products that are sort of so bad for us that come to him. It could go either way. It is manipulative. And yet we could use it to help us sort of, almost without noticing, transition to a slightly less salty, slightly less sugary diet.
Well, you tried one of the experiments that Spence conducted, one with beer and music. Now, how does this work?
So this is based on that sort of relationship between pitch, high-pitched sounds and sweetness, lower-pitched sounds and bitterness. And I was with Spence at a beer festival. And what was so funny about this is it's a beer festival on a Saturday night in London, and everybody's already slightly merry or even beyond slightly merry. And, you know, there's all sorts of chaos. And suddenly this Oxford University scientist shows up and starts trying to give a presentation. No one's paying attention, you can imagine. Then he tries this experiment, and the crowd just fell silent. Because what he does is he plays a high-pitched piece of music, asks you to take a sip of your beer. And then he plays a lower-pitched piece, asks you to take another sip of the same beer. And I just looked around the room, and my own response was the same. I'd done this before in the lab with him, but even having done it before and knowing what I was expected to feel, you just cannot help it. The beer tastes different. It's the same beer, and it tastes like a different beer. It's astonishing. It goes from this bitter, hoppy, all of those hoppy, tannicky notes to being, when the high-pitched music is on, it's soft and creamy and slightly fruitier. Incredible.
Well, Nicola, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Nicola Twilley, she wrote an article for The New Yorker about the illusion of taste and several different multi-sensory perception experiments that are being done with food. She is also co-host of the Gastropod podcast. You'll find a link to both at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about how sound can alter one's sense of taste. Now to how traumatic historical events can change taste and cuisine. After Pearl Harbor, about 120,000 Japanese Americans were uprooted and forced to live for years in remote federal camps around the country. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, explore the impact of internment on Japanese cooking and culture in America in a story they call Weenie Royale.
My name is Akemi Tamaribuchi, and I'm third-generation Japanese-American. During World War II, my family was interned in Tule Lake internment camp. I'm positive that so many of the dishes that I grew up eating stemmed from what they had in camp and how they incorporated that into their tastes. Fried bologna with a little sugar and a little soy sauce on top. Hot dogs and everything. They use things like ketchup and hot water for soup bases. We eat ketchup on everything. Weenie Royale and Hamburger Royale, they're my favorites. Sunday mornings we always had sliced hot dogs mixed with eggs with soy sauce and a little oyster sauce, stir-fried in with some onions over rice.
My father was Ito Ikemoto. Everybody called him Ed. He made that his official name after the war. He was a grocer. He had three grocery stores, and he lost them all, of course. My name's Howard Ikemoto. After the war, a lot of the Japanese came back to places like Sacramento, and they had no jobs. And a lot of them got pickup trucks and became gardeners. When I was 12 years old, I would go every Saturday to work with my father. Every lunch, all the Japanese gardeners would meet in front of people that they were mowing lawns for. We used to eat rice with one plum in the middle, and then maybe have a slice of Spam, corned beef hash out of a can. That was part of our main diet in camp. And while they were having their lunch, they would talk about the camps, which was the prime of their life.
My name is Tammy Takahashi. I'm a native of San Francisco. I went to UC Berkeley in the 30s, the depths of depression. I lived my whole life here, except for the 4 years of World War II. Everybody, if they had a drop of Japanese blood, 1/16, we were all gathered up and put into camps. Our camp, Topaz, each person was given a tin pie plate that held our meals. Even now, 70 years later, if I look at a tin pie plate, it brings back memories.
My name is Moss Kawaguchi. I'm 79 years old. When I was evacuated, they sent me over to Tamfran Racetrack. I had to live in a stable 6 months. You could still see the hairs on the floor, and you could still smell the horses. They told us that you're supposed to bring your own mess gear. Being a Boy Scout, I knew what to bring. They had a big hall. All 8,000 of us had to march in there with your mess gear in hand.
You lined up for your food and then sat down at these long tables and ate there. Yeah, everybody squeezed in where they could. Just broke apart the family because the kids were running around. There was no family dinner.
Somebody else was cooking your dinner. It wasn't your mother. That part of the family life was just institutionalized. My name is Jean Wilkotsky Houston. I was 7 years old. We went to Mazanar. It was bleak, desert.
The cook in our mess hall and Block 11 was a Coast Guard military cook, a grizzly old cranky guy, not very friendly disposed to the idea of children and women. It was determined that only children from birth to 12 years of age would be given 6 ounces of milk, maximum. And I was pregnant, but he wouldn't give me any milk.
We were very unused to eating potatoes. It was not something that was part of our regular diet. My father and mother ate rice every day of their life. Rice is certainly a soul food for Japanese Americans.
They had dirt floors in the barracks. My great-grandmother would dig a hole and ferment her own rice wine or sake and store it buried in the dirt. That was a big secret that wasn't allowed in the camps.
Every block had sake makers. Everybody had any connection with the mess hall. They scrape all the rice off the bottom of the pan and they'll make sake. My name is Jim Yamaichi. I spent 3 years in Tui Lake. You see that concrete thing over there? There used to be a guard tower in that corner. That's the slaughterhouse where they slaughtered the hogs, rendering the fat. The soap was made right there and took into the mess hall. This is where the chicken coop used to be. Tui Lake was one of the biggest farm camps. We supplied most of all the vegetables to other camps. 3,800 acres of farmland. Internees did the farming. You bring a carload of hot dogs and come in by the tons, and we eat hot dogs for days, you know.
My father decided he was going to have a family dinner Christmas time, and he was going around the camp bragging to his friends that he was going to have a goose for Christmas. Everybody was mocking him. There was no place to cook a goose, and then where are you going to get a goose anyway, right? Tule Lake is a flyway for Canadian geese. So he dug this trench and laid down, put some gunny sack over himself, and put feed in the trench. And sure enough, the geese came down and their wings were trapped. My father threw the gunny sack onto the geese. Every barrack had this potbelly stove, and he actually roasted it in there. And we had our Christmas goose.
My name is Shosei Hanayama, minister of Watson Buddhist Temple. After World War II in Yokohama, so many Americans came, Army and Navy, and they brought, you know, a hot dog. It's an American cuisine, you know, every year on Independence Day. They have a contest in New York City. Japanese young guy, you know, every year he ate over 50 hot dogs he ate in a couple minutes.
This year's Nathan's hot dog eating contest. Takiro Kobayashi hoping to swallow the competition.
He's showing us a couple different looks. Right now he's Japanese-ing and solid-ing. He's breaking the dog in half, separating dog from bun. Still the man to be beat. He is the Lance Armstrong of our...
Some of my closest friends, they've even heard of the fact that the Japanese were interned. And there's so many things that have affected our culture, at least that came out of there, like the food. To be honest, I think that the Japanese culture is very silent. Nobody ever complains or talks about any bad times. And my grandmother, my Oba-chan, she's 85 years old. Now she has all of a sudden become far more sensitive to wanting all of her family to understand where everything came from. You know, we lost so much of it. It's just like, call all the grandkids and Bachan's making weenie royale for breakfast. Come spend time so that you learn how to make this food so you can make it for your children and their children.
And that story was brought to us by the Kitchen Sisters, producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, and it was mixed by Jim McKee. Public Radio takes great care in bringing you stories that pique your interest and satisfy your curiosity and inform you on news events throughout the states and the world. If Public Radio is a valuable part of your life, put a value on it now and show your support during NHPR's March Fund Drive.